Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse, brought to you every Thursday here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio. I'm John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab, my co-host. How are you doing this evening, Ray?
I'm good, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well because we have a very interesting topic today, Jews and Muslims in America. And our guest is Dr. Sharon Albert. Ray, what do we know about Dr. Albert?
Well, Dr. Sharon Albert teaches in the Religious Studies Department at Muhlenberg with courses focusing on Islam, Judaism, gender studies, and comparative religion. Her doctoral work at the University of Chicago focused on interactions between Jews and Muslims in the Middle Ages. But since teaching at Muhlenberg, her interests have become more current and more local, with a focus on Muslims and Jews in the 21st century U.S., with particular attention to issues of gender and diversity within those communities. Professor Albert also speaks regularly with Islam or about Islam to local community groups.
So, Dr. Albert, welcome to our microphones.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I met Dr. Albert a couple of years ago when it was announced that she was teaching a course at Muhlenberg College called Islam in America. And I asked her if I could sit in on that course. She didn't know me at all, and she said, sure, come along if you want to. And it turned out to be very interesting, and lots of very interesting discussion that was generated among the students. And there was a variety of students. You even had at least one Muslim student
in
that
course. There were two or three.
Two or three.
Every Muslim at Muhlenberg College, I think.
So, Dr. Albert, what are your beginnings? You're not from the United States. I detect a distinct accent.
Yes, I'm from Canada originally.
All right. Faraway Canada.
Faraway Canada. Faraway cold Canada. Yeah, I'm from Canada. Did graduate work in Dublin and then spent a little bit of time in Jerusalem before coming to Chicago where I did my doctoral work. And then I lived in lots of big cities and then moved to Allentown in about 10 years ago when my husband got a job at the history department at Muhlenberg College.
Let's send a shout out to Dr. Mark Stein, mm-hmm. who is perhaps listening. If he's not, you will talk later.
That's right.
Correct?
It should be.
What is your husband's focus in history?
And he teaches Middle East history, particularly Turkish history, the Ottoman Empire.
And I sat in on one of his courses too, right?
Yeah. What'd you think, John?
I'm just a leech.
Who's better, John?
I'm not going to get into that one tonight. But so all the way from Canada by way of Ireland and where else?
I was in Jerusalem for a while.
Jerusalem,
yeah.
And then Chicago. When were you at the University of Chicago? Because I was there too.
From about 1994, I think, to about 2000.
Oh, she's so young. Right? I was there from 67 to 70. But the curious thing
I was born then, John.
I asked the colleague one time, I said, where were you in 1964? He looks at me and he says, John, I wasn't born yet. Does that make me feel old? And the interesting thing is that you were interested in the Middle Ages in your studies at the University of Chicago, and so was I, but it was in French. It was Middle Ages from the European point of view. So you're here for 10 years now at Muhlenberg College. What are the courses that that you find the most interesting to teach? What do you really love to teach?
Oh, that's an I love to teach just about everything that I teach, but certainly what I bring to Muhlenberg in the department is courses on Islamic traditions. I teach Islam in America. I've taught courses on reading the Quran. So I get excited to teach it because I think it's so important for people to be thinking, learning, knowing more about Islam today in America. I teach a lot of, as I said before, a lot of gender courses. I teach one course that I'm actually teaching this semester called Monotheism, Creating God. which is a fun course for me. I think sometimes throws students for a loop a little bit because we reconsider, it's not just about what, it's not just the history of monotheism, it's sort of a reconsideration of what monotheism is, means, why we value it.
So instead of God creating us, we're creating God? Ooh, this sounds very 18th century.
Now, how do the students react to something like a class like that?
Oh, the students love it. The students it's, although I have to say it's good students love it. It's and I've got only good students if any of them are listening this semester. We deal with a lot of abstractions, which can be difficult.
But now, have a lot of these students been exposed to ideas like that before or thought about monotheism in that way?
No. One of the reasons it's a fun course to teach is because I find that very often students think about ideas they've never thought about before.
So you can see it from when they had first sort of thought about it in that way and how it develops through the course.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's very interesting.
They have to be thinking differently at the end of that course from the way they thought at the beginning.
I hope they're thinking differently at the end of all of my courses. And one of the things that I find very exciting is the way that courses connect. So, you know, this semester I'm teaching the monotheism course. I'm teaching Islam in America again. And I'm teaching a course called Sex, Gender, and Religion. And they all intersect and come together in really fun, interesting ways.
So. Right. Speaking of monotheism, Ray, an idea that really surprised me was hearing that in some quarters, certain Muslims consider Christianity not to be monotheism because of the Trinity. So, what do we do with that?
I would say that certain Protestants consider Catholics not to be monotheists because of the Trinity. Trinity and monotheism becomes problematic, and it's absolutely explicable. One of the things that I think is often that I love to talk about when I talk about Islam, people often think that Muhammad and Jesus are parallel, and you certainly can draw some parallels. They're both charismatic figures. Jesus is an important figure within Islamic tradition, but Islam is a very, very strictly, I would say in some ways, of the three major monotheistic religions, the one that is most overtly and consciously monotheist, and I say that carefully, but if anything in Islam is going to be compared to Jesus, it actually becomes the Quran, because Jesus for Christians is the word of God, and the Quran is the word of God. And so if anything, that's the closer parallel, which I think often surprises people, because Muhammad is not divine. Muhammad is not a god.
That's similar to almost how some people will think of Buddhism and almost think of the Buddha as the god of the religion, when really that's not necessarily the case.
Right, right. A very similar, a good parallel, absolutely. Yeah.
So who are the Jews and Muslims in America today?
That's a good and interesting question. I sort of want to pretend I'm in a classroom and say, who do you think they are?
Oh, Ray, we're on the hot seat now.
But I'll say, I guess one of the things to note is that the population of Jews and Muslims, by most people's estimates, and obviously it's not something that anybody knows exact numbers for, you don't ask questions like that on a census, are probably pretty similar, and they're probably about 1% of the American population each. And one of the reasons I ask is many people make a very quick conflation and say, oh, Muslims, well, they're Arab immigrants. And in fact, about a third of Muslims in America today are Arab Americans or are of Arabic origin, but probably a little bit more than a third are South Asian, And then about a third are African American or are converts to Islam. So you really almost have divisions into thirds. And many of them, many Muslims were born here. Many Muslims have been here for many generations. So Muslims aren't immigrants by definition. Muslims are across the demographic spectrum. And one of the things, and I don't know if you remember, John, I teach in my classes the 1.6 billion rule, which I think in the United States, do you remember the 1.6 billion rule?
I don't remember. Refresh my memory.
The 1.6 billion rule is that there are approximately, by many people's estimations, and obviously there are more or less, about 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. It's a major world religion with a lot of people. And what that means is that it's a lot of diversity. There's a lot of diversity in what people do. There's a lot of diversity in where people come from. There's a lot of diversity in what people wear. I remember one of my early years teaching Islam. The first day of class, I got students to sit in groups and talk about what they knew, what they didn't know, and some students were giggling in the back of the classroom. And I was walking around, and I came over and said, oh, why are you giggling? And they said, and one of them said, well, this other one was wondering if you were a Muslim. And I said, oh, you know, and I don't generally reveal my own religious propensities to my students. And I said, oh, okay. And the student said, but I told them that you weren't. Of course you're not. And I said, well, why? And the person said, well, the way you're dressed. So I had to say, joke's on you. In fact, I'm dressed like many, many Muslims would, many Muslim women would be dressed. There's a lot of diversity in everything. And that's true in America, too, obviously.
Right. And that dress is the way you would see most women in this country.
Right, right.
And no headscarf and not a flowing robe and so on.
So how could we characterize, you had said how the Muslim population in America would split into thirds. How would you characterize each of those groups and what are the differences between them? How they dress and how they practice.
Well, when I say they're split into thirds, let me be careful about it. And I'll certainly make those distinctions. There's a lot of variation, other variations amongst the variations that I've spoken of. Mm-hmm. You have immigrant communities. And you don't necessarily have first generation. You often have second generation or third generation immigrants. Middle Eastern Muslims coming from the Middle East are, I think, the Muslims that most people make this immediate association with. And again, Muslims from the Middle East can come from Palestine. They can come from Syria. They can come from Saudi Arabia. One interesting thing about Allentown is Allentown has, as you both may be aware, Allentown has a very large Syrian population. Many of the Syrians in Allentown are, in fact, Christian Syrians. So again, Middle East and Muslim, we have to be very careful about making that kind of conflation. Some of the South Asian Muslims in Allentown, There's also another distinction that I haven't talked about. In Allentown, we have a number of different communities. There's the Muslim Association of the Lehigh Valley, and say this carefully, probably the largest Muslim community. It's a Sunni Muslim community. There's a Shia Muslim community, many of whom are South Asian Muslims, who came over probably about 20 to 30 years ago. And then there is a significant population of Turkish Muslims in Allentown as well.
Well, and also I know something about Easton, where I live, and there are plenty of Lebanese families in Easton, and there's also a Christian church there.
Right.
Our Lady of, and I can't remember the name, in downtown Easton.
Yeah.
So you have more Syrians in Allentown, more Lebanese in Easton. I don't know about Bethlehem.
Offhand, I don't know either.
It is a fact, I think, that most of us, when we think of Islam, think of the Middle East because of Mecca and Medina, and that those are the big, important places in the history of Islam. But I heard that something like only about 12% of Islams and of Muslims in the world, I think, are from the Middle East. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's not the majority.
Not at all.
Again, I'll see, John, if you remember from our class, which country has the largest...
Indonesia.
Indonesia, right. Yeah.
And, of course, it's a hugely populous nation anyway. And so, and I would assume almost all are Muslims.
In Indonesia?
In Indonesia.
Yeah, there are significant minorities, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we have these groups in the United States, and we are we're speaking here on Lehigh Valley Discourse with Dr. Sharon Albert, who's a professor of religious studies at Muhlenberg College, and our subject is Jews and Muslims in America. So, Sharon, since you are from Canada, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, why do the Canadians cede the term Americans to the U.S. people? America, as far as I know, is from the north of Canada down to the Cape of Horn and Argentina and Chile, and it bothers me when we say, what's best for America? We're not talking about any other country except our own. And when I went to Canada and I would hear people, or I hear them on interviews talking about the Americans, everybody agrees that we are the Americans here in the U.S. What's going on?
That's a really good question. I hope some of my American family is listening. My Canadian family, I'm sorry. Because people get very touchy in Canada. We often talk about North America, you know, and the...
Which includes Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
Right, absolutely. Right. And my family will make distinctions when they talk about London. They'll make sure that they're talking about London, England, or London, Ontario. Kingston, you've got to make sure that you're talking about, you know, Kingston, Ontario, or Funky Kingston in Jamaica.
The music is different.
The music is exactly, exactly.
Right. Well, that's a question. That's just one of my quirks, Ray, that bothers me, mostly because I've studied Spanish and Latin American cultures, and but many times and you'll find in Latino countries also, when they say Los Americanos, they're talking about people from the U.S. Sometimes they will say Norte Americanos to make it a little bit more distinct.
That still leaves us out as Canadians.
But that's right. So. That's exactly right. So... you have not spoken to us yet, Sharon, about your ability to ice skate and to get into ice hockey. What's that about? About?
Huh? Well, I keep telling my kids that they have to learn to ice skate at some point, because otherwise they both have passports, because I'm Canadian, and otherwise they'll have to have their passports revoked, but it hasn't happened yet. So.
And if you have a Canadian passport and you try to go through an airport, Ray, without ice skates, highly suspect. You could be pulled to the side. Is that a stereotype?
Absolutely. A good one, though.
When I was young and getting into interest in sports, and I was brought up in the Chicago area, so it was the Chicago Blackhawks. And when I found out that my heroes, like Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita, were Canadian, and my father knew that, and he said, oh, almost all the play. And in those days, it was only six teams, two in Canada and four in the U.S. And he said, well, just about all the players are Canadian. I thought he was a genius for knowing that. Since then, I've learned.
Yeah. Well, I was in Edmonton when the Edmonton Oilers lost Wayne Gretzky, and the town was in mourning.
Oh wow! Black draped all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Oh man, I understand. Ray, it's time for us to take a break, right?
Yep.
And we will be back in 60 seconds to talk more about Jews and Muslims in the U.S. Thank you.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater on Bethlehem Southside in their 32nd season, presenting Ulysses Dreams, an exploration of origin and destiny, performed by the Touchstone Ensemble. This modern adaptation of the adventures of the hero Ulysses is performed in the form of a song cycle dealing with the characters of Ulysses and his relationship with various women in his life. April 13th to the 21st. For tickets or information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're speaking this evening with Dr. Sharon Albert, professor from Muhlenberg College, who teaches in the Religious Studies Department, speaking today about Jews and Muslims in America. Dr. Albert, when I sat in on her course, I noticed throughout the whole semester, class after class, that she never did divulge her own religion, which is Judaism. And I said to myself at the end of the course, and I think this is a high compliment, I would not have known that you were Jewish by the way you taught the course, not at all. So I'm not too surprised that there was confusion among the students that you mentioned before that, you know, she must be Muslim or no, she can't be Muslim. But because of the way you were dressed. So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Jews and Muslims in the United States now. Is there antagonism? Has there always been antagonism? How would you evaluate that situation?
My own interest in studying Islam emerged, as you said earlier, from studying the Middle Ages. And the area for me that was of particular interest was Muslim Spain. And Muslims enter Spain in about 711, which is not long after the Muslim Empire has emerged, and Muslim has emerged. And Muslims have control over parts of Spain until 1492. Another thing I often ask students and say, 1492, what happened? Well, right. You know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. There was the expulsion of Jews from Spain, and there was also the fall of Granada. So if you have about 700 years of Muslim rule in Spain, and it's an era that is called the era of convivencia. And being a scholar of Spanish, John, you can hear some of the resonances right. of it. It's really an era when In what often gets called the Dark Ages, we think about the Middle Ages as this era when there is really, when things are very backward. Not only are there some remarkable scientific advances within Muslim Spain and within the Muslim world writ more large, there are some cultural advances, but one of the things that's really striking about some of this period in Muslim Spain is that there is a remarkable level of, I'm wary about saying tolerance, but so certainly coexistence that arguably amongst Jews, Muslims, and Christians, that I would say you could argue we don't see repeated at least until today, and some might even argue that we don't see it repeated today. So there's certainly, you know, historically, Jews and Muslims have actually had a lot in common, and there's actually been a lot more commonality and a lot less antagonism. I don't think that there's necessary, I would like to hope that there's not particular animosity between Jews and Muslims in the United States today, but certainly there's a lot of what we call Islamophobia, and I'm sure that's a term that you're familiar with. There's a lot of fear that I think emerges from misunderstanding.
Right, but also from bombings that happen, from what we call terrorism. So should we be afraid of Muslims? That's a question that a lot of people, I think, have on their minds.
Sure. And my answer to that would be we should be afraid of terrorists. We should be afraid of terrorists who come in whatever formulation they do. There are all kinds of global issues that account for why we might find terrorism occurring in certain parts of the world more than others. You can get me started on hobby horses of mine, but we live in a very inequitable world in many ways.
Inequitable.
Inequitable. But Muslims, you know, Muslims are a significant portion of the world's population, and most Muslims, by such a ridiculous long shot, aren't terrorists. And in fact, most Muslims that I know personally would say that they're offended by the people who are terrorists even being considered Muslims, that what they're doing is not something that aligns with Muslim values.
Right. And when we're outside of the group, mostly we don't see the fissures within the group. And there are definitely different strains of Islam, and there's not agreement among all of them on many issues, as we would expect.
Right. Well, and the terrorists, and it's like, you know, we don't hold everybody accountable for Timothy McVeigh and the bombing in Oklahoma, and we don't turn around and say, well, look at what white people do, or look at what Christians do, right? We look at it and go, oh, look at that crazy person.
Good point.
And we're much more likely, lots of terrorism occurs that we don't even hear about, because it only makes news if it's newsworthy.
Right.
And
if it's their group versus our group,
right,
so to speak.
And
we want to let the listeners know that if you have any questions for Dr. Albert, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. Once again, that's 610-758-8810.
And Ray does that without notes. He knows that number cold.
That's right.
My impressive co-host.
Can I say one other thing, John? Is, you know, I'll often, another thing that students will often say to me is they'll say, well, how come moderate Muslims don't speak up? And I have to tell you that I invite anybody who says that to, they can't just come to my office because my office isn't big enough. They have to come to my office and to my house and see the walls and rows of books and see all of the many things that are all of the ways that that Muslims are shouting out. And I know Muslims who don't like the term moderate Muslim, because there are implications there that it's not about being moderate or not. It's like, you know, is Islam a religion of peace? Well, is Christianity a religion of peace? If it is, we've got a lot of explaining to do about a number of things that have gone on, not the least of which is the Crusades. But there are lots of Muslims speaking out, but we're much more interested in hearing about bombings than we are in hearing about peaceful interactions and getting along.
Yeah, peace is not what makes news.
No,
unfortunately, and that's for sure. We're speaking with Dr. Sharon Albert of Muhlenberg College, and she's speaking this evening with us about Jews and Muslims in America. I think that you listened to an interview that I did with one of the imams. He happens to be from New Jersey. His name is Mustafa Zayed, and it was during the time that I was taking your course. In fact, confession here that I took your course partly to get ready for that interview, because I knew so little about Islam. And I was much better prepared for that interview thanks to your course. That was a couple of years ago. And he, I lost my train of thought now. As I was getting ready to do that interview, I spoke with a couple of Arab men who were setting me up with him to get me in touch with Imam Zayed. And at lunch, the matter of terrorism came up. And so one of them asked me, well, what's a terrorist? Is it somebody who comes in a car and blows it up and kills 7 people? Or is it an airplane that drops bombs that kills 200 people at a time? And so that made me think, terrorism from your point of view. I mean,
yeah. Well, and an interesting instance of that, I think it might have been last fall, I was teaching a course about Islam, and I often have my students read the news and look at things that had come in, and somebody had done a survey of rural Afghani illiterate men, and I still wonder about how you do a survey. I think it's impressive that one can do a survey of, but one of the things that emerged from the survey is that when they interviewed these rural Afghanis, they didn't know about 9/11. 9/11, which is so central and important for us, was really not something that was on their radar screen at all. But they knew that every day they had American planes flying over their heads, dropping bombs. Absolutely.
So these men, why did they think that was happening?
Why did they think they
the planes were overhead, you mean?
Yeah, why did they think that the Americans were over there doing that, if not for 9/11?
Well, they just, I think they just didn't know. I think they just thought these Americans are coming, they hate us. Right? Okay. Just like we think they hate, they hate us, they think, you know, it was the same thing. They were just thinking, who knows, they're in a position of privilege and power and they hate us. I don't know, because that wasn't part of the survey data, but I can only imagine they didn't have access to news the way we did.
Right, right.
And it wasn't as central, because it wasn't happening to them. Horrible things happen all over the world, and we don't pay a whole lot of attention.
And at the moment of 9/11, right in those days following that, I don't know if you remember, probably on news reports, we saw visions of Arabic people in the streets in their country, shouting and jumping up and down, and you would have thought it was New Year's or some great celebration. That they had poked Uncle Sam in the eye with the downing of the Twin Towers. And so that adds to our idea that, well, then it must be that all Muslims are joyful when something like this happens and you kill 3,000 people.
And again, to give a parallel, there are Christian groups, which, let me be very clear, are extreme minority Christian groups, who protest at military funerals because of American laws about, because American acceptance of gays and lesbians in the military, and they protest at military funerals. So dissimilar.
So if that makes the news, then people would say, well, look at the Christians. Look what they believe. What are some of the similarities that you find between Islam and Judaism, generally speaking?
Generally or in America? Should I start generally?
Generally.
There really are a lot of striking similarities. I think an easy one that in many ways, an easy one that aligns Judaism and Christianity, that's a little bit different from many variations. And again, Judaism and like Islam, Judaism and Christianity are very broad terms, and there's a lot of variants. Is that they're both? I'll use a jargony term a little bit here. They're both orthopraxes, meaning that both Judaism and Islam involve in traditional formulations, and there are non-traditional formulations, but in traditional formulations, involve a lot of day-to-day activity and practice. So there are things that you have to do. You have to pray in Judaism 3 times a day. In Islam, you have to pray 5 times a day. You have to, there are certain foods. Jews keep kosher. Muslims want to eat meat and eat food that is halal.
But then again, within Jewish groups and Muslim groups, that varies.
Right,
there are,
absolutely.
There are Jews who do not hold to kosher. Is it true?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then Muslims who presumably do not pray 5 times a day. But that's the way the religion is set up, that they're supposed to do. That's the ideal.
Well, I think that's the ideal. But again, as with any religious group, there are people who would say, oh, well, but you don't have to do that. And there are certainly, there's some core things that most people would agree with. But even within that, there are variations about how you do it. One of the interesting things with veiling. And I think we talked about clothing a little bit ago, and certainly the student who was thinking I couldn't be Muslim was thinking I couldn't be Muslim because I wasn't veiled, my hair wasn't covered. And in fact, there was an imam in Britain after 9/11 who said that Muslim women shouldn't veil because it was putting them in danger. And this was, and there have been other voices who at various points have said that. So because it was putting them in danger and therefore their lives were more important.
Right.
And so something like that becomes a moment where there's room for flexibility.
Now, speaking a little more locally, what are some similarities between Judaism and Islam in America?
I would say that the Jews and Muslims both suffer many of the issues that minorities suffer. There are concerns about, there are concerns about schooling. And so, again, depending, and there are Jews and Muslims who just are, you would never know from anything they do. They go to public school and dress the same as everybody else. And then there are people who want to make sure that their children have a different education. I'm going to say not a different education, but an education that incorporates some of the things that are particular to them. I think we tend to forget just how, even though we're a country where we separate church and state, so much of the foundation of what we do is Christian. You know, Christmas is a holiday. We all get Christmas off. We all get Easter off. Sundays, there are limits on what we can
do. Except for the pastors.
Exactly.
Ray, when you put in your application to be a pastor, don't put on it, "I do not work on Sundays." This is not smart.
Unless you want to be a Jewish pastor or a Muslim pastor.
Now, do you find some of these similarities in America help alleviate some of the tension that there is between Jews and Muslims?
No, and I think in some ways, I guess... I feel like I don't want to get into dangerous muddy territory, but that's when it gets fun on the radio, right? One of the issues, and you had asked John about the history of antagonism, and historically I would suggest that there hasn't been a lot of antagonism. There's been a lot more antagonism since the early 20th century, since the creation of the State of Israel and the situation of the Palestinians. And this has become it's a really, really complex, problematic, difficult issue, one that you'd be better set to have my husband on the radio to speak about, because he is a Middle East historian and has more expertise than I. But one of the results of this has been, a heightened antagonism between Jews and Muslims in some quarters, and not across the boards for sure, but in some quarters where really, really, I look at it and think about things, and I know, I see we're coming up to a break, but something I would love after the break to talk a little bit about some of the prohibitions and people who've been concerned about Sharia law, for instance. Well, Jews practice a variation of Sharia law, and I look at the situation and think, wouldn't it be great if we could have people standing arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder, saying, if this affects Muslims, it affects Jews, let's be standing together and be concerned about the same issues, because there's a lot of commonality.
We'll come back to that after our break, as you say. Dr. Sharon Albert is with us on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening, and we're talking about Jews and Muslims in the United States. Ray, let's give that telephone number another time.
If you have any questions on our topic tonight, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. And it looks like we have a caller on the line right now. If you hold through the break, we'll get to you. This is WDIY.
WDIY is proud to present the 13th annual Heart of the Valley Antique Show on March 2nd and 3rd. Come see 25 exhibitors featuring Americana, including textiles, furniture, pottery, folk art, toys, and much more. The show is held in the historic Charles Brown Ice House in the heart of historic Bethlehem. For show hours, directions, or information, WDIY.org.
And you're back with Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY with our host, John Pierce. We want to go to the phones right now. And caller, would you give us your name?
Hi, my name's Alyssa.
Alyssa, where are you calling from?
Bethlehem.
All right, Bethlehem of Judea or of Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania.
Did you know that they can actually hear WDIY in Judea?
Yes, online.
Oh, you're wonderful. Thank you. What's your question or comment?
I had a question. With Judaism, we have divisions such as Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, and Reconstructionist. I was wondering if there are American, you know, sort of divisions in Islam, because I know you mentioned when you were talking about overseas, Sunni, and whatever the other one is, and I don't know what those are, and so I'm just wanted to know about the subdivisions.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Alyssa. I think I know who Alyssa is, and I
yes, do.
The Sunni and Shia divisions are not just overseas. They're divisions amidst Islam as a whole. But I think you're talking about something different here. And within Judaism in the United States and in Europe in particular, there are what get defined as movements. There are these very concrete groups who are very institutionalized. And you don't have quite the same institutionalization as far as I know. That said, you certainly, you probably have something more akin to groupings who will follow different leaders. And again, one of the things that actually parallels Islam and Judaism is, unlike some forms of Christianity, unlike something like Catholicism, we've been hearing a lot about the Pope lately, and the Pope is the final, ultimate, authoritative voice. In both Judaism and Christianity, there's a long tradition of following scholars. Following scholars or teachers.
Did you mean to say Judaism and Islam?
And Islam, I'm sorry, thank you, Judaism and Islam. So you have the what get called the ulama. An alim is a scholar, and the ulama are the group of scholars. And so people will go to someone particular for advice, or there will be groupings. So, for instance, there are, there's a group who, in the last 10 years, who are progressive Muslims talk about what it means to be a progressive Muslim as opposed to, and use the term progressive very intentionally rather than, say, liberal. And so there aren't the same institutionalized distinctions. But again, there are, just as there are Jews who practice or don't practice for all kinds of reasons and all kinds of ways, there's a similar, they're not as institutionalized, but there certainly are similar distinctions.
Alyssa, did you want to add anything?
That was a great answer. I just wanted to know about the term Sunni and Shiite. Could you explain those a little?
Sure. Sunni Muslims, most Muslims in the world, probably somewhere around 85% of Muslims in the world today are Sunni Muslims. About 10 to 15% are Shia Muslims. And the key distinction probably has to do with authority and how authority is understood. It dates back historically to the death of Muhammad, who was a very charismatic man, who was a very charismatic leader, who was a religious leader but also a political leader, and a religious, political, military. And after his death, there was some contention, as often happens after the death of charismatic leaders, about who should follow. And there were four, what get called the four rightly guided caliphs, the four rightly guided caliphs followed, the fourth of whom was Ali. But there were some people who believed that Ali should have been the direct descendant because of a connection to Muhammad. And so the one of the key distinctions is an understanding how authority and leadership plays itself out. So for Shia Muslims, there is a sense that there should be an imam who is I say very carefully, more akin to a figure like the Pope, where you have authoritative leadership. The one trick is that within 12 generations, and many Shia Muslims, the majority of Shia Muslims, I believe, are Ithna Ashari Shia Muslims, meaning 12ers, people who go 12 generations from Muhammad. After 12 generations, the imam no longer is available and will come back at an end time, or you know, a later time close to judgment. So the Shia Muslims don't have that leader, don't have that authority today in any case. And again, it can get more complicated, but there's a lot of similarity in practice. So
it's kind of like the distinction between Christians and Catholics, where the Catholics, you know, sort of put the Pope as having, you know, more of an authority.
You meant Protestants and Roman Catholics.
Protestants, I want to be careful about generalizations, but in a very general way, if you said, okay, but the Pope's not available right now, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Alyssa, thank you for your call.
Okay, sure, bye-bye.
Bye.
And as we said earlier, it's very problematic to be making those parallels between religions like that. Understanding certain aspects of Islam in terms of Christianity, that can be pretty problematic.
Oh, very problematic, yeah. Yeah, and you know, I think we sometimes, that helps, it's the way we can understand things. But that said, it causes, you've got to be very careful about those kind of parallels because they always fall short.
Right.
Yeah.
Dr. Sharon Albert is speaking with us this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse about Jews and Muslims in the United States. Right here in the Lehigh Valley, we have an Islamic center on Schott Avenue in Whitehall. And they do have Friday noon prayer gatherings. There's an imam who goes there. They have their service, and they welcome anyone who wants to go and just see what a service is like.
Absolutely.
If you go to a prayer service in an Islam setting, you're going to have people on their knees on the floor. And we've seen pictures of that even in news reports and so on. And the head goes down to the floor at certain points and that kind of thing. But visitors can sit in chairs in the back.
Yes.
And I asked, I went to one of those services once where Imam Zayed was leading the service. And I asked him afterwards why he did that in English instead of Arabic. And his answer was, many of the people there don't speak Arabic, of course. And here I was in the mindset that, of course, they're Arabs if they're Muslims. So we've broken that myth this evening.
Now, before the break, you said that you wanted to speak a little more about some of the prohibitions in Islam and Judaism. Did you want to say anything more about
that? Oh, and Sharia law.
And Sharia law,
because
yes.
One of the things that in the last few years, there's a lot of concern in America about Sharia law and what that means, and will Sharia law overtake American law, and you know, and we're talking about Jews and Muslims in some of the parallels. And for people who are familiar with traditional Jewish practice, there's something called halacha. And halacha is Jewish law. And both halacha, Jewish law, and Sharia, Muslim law, Sharia literally means the path. And quite frankly, halacha is very similar kinds of meanings, a way of life. Both of them are a set of laws that, first of all, like any legal system, particularly one that has been around, think about it, how complex and complicated American law is. And it's been I'm an American by choice, so every 200 years. when you look at the legal systems that are Sharia and halakha, they're extremely complex. There are different schools of thought. There are different interpretive issues. And more importantly, most of the laws don't involve the kinds of things that would come anywhere near conflicting with American laws. They include things like laws about how to deal with prayer. They include things about laws like how to deal with marriage and divorce. And one of the things that's really striking to me is, again, as I've said, this is one of the places where if people are concerned about Sharia law and are trying to ban Sharia law, as has been happening in a number of places in the United States, this is one place for sure where Jewish communities who are traditional and observant practitioners of Judaism should be standing up shouting from the rooftops, because if we're going to outlaw Sharia, we have to outlaw halacha too. They're both legal systems that could conceivably conflict. And I would strongly say that we shouldn't, if we really separate church from state, we shouldn't be, we certainly shouldn't be outlawing either of them. But this is a place where there's a lot of similarity and a lot of parallelism.
Interesting. Let's go on to, one of the comments that I wanted to make was, I think that from most Americans' point of view, when we think about and see pictures of women either wearing the headscarves or veiled completely, we think that those poor women, they are being put upon. It's imprisonment. They're not free to dress the way they want to. And from the women's point of view, that's really not the case, is it?
Well, you know what? I want us to be careful. I'm so glad you asked that, John, because it's a fun, not fun. So it's a fun, but it's also an important thing to talk about. One of the things that for me is particularly interesting is the way that Muslim women who choose to veil and Muslim women who don't choose to veil and are forced to veil, Muslim women who wear the veil for whatever reason, really become remarkable symbols. In a way that, as someone who's very concerned about women's issues, it's really interesting because women in veils become the representation for people who are afraid of Islam or are concerned about Islam in any way. All of a sudden, women in veils become this horrible, worrying thing. First of all, as you said, for many women, certainly if you see a woman who's veiled in America, the likelihood that it is her choice is remarkably high. If you go to Afghanistan or if you go to Iran, you're going to see women who are not choosing to veil. But that, I would suggest, has as much to do with politics and with local practice and again, with politics and with difficult politics and political situations as it does with any kind of specific prohibition. One of the things I talk about with my classes very often is what are we talking about when we talk about Muslim dress? And Muslim dress versus Islamic dress. Islamic dress being what does Islam demand, and Muslim dress being what do Muslims actually wear? And I would say that Islamic dress, you can read the Quran, there are all kinds of interesting things demanding interpretation. Bottom line is a call for modesty for everybody. Now, how do we interpret modesty? Modesty we can interpret as full body covering, or modesty we can interpret as, you know, don't show your belly button in public. There, one of the interesting things that has happened with veiling, even over the past, even since 9/11, is there are people who wear the veil because of piety. There are people who wear the veil because they feel, and women who wear the veil because they feel that it's appropriate and what they should do. There are women who wear the veil as a political statement. There are women who wear the veil. There are women who wear the veil because they're Muslim, who veil because they're Muslims, and they want the world to know that they're Muslims, and that's the way they can stand up and say, "Look, I'm a Muslim, and I'm proud to be a Muslim."
Well, and there's also the tradition in the family. If the mother is probably wearing the headscarf, and probably her mother is, and then the child comes along, and then at a certain age, a girl chooses, doesn't
Absolutely.
She? In this country,
in,
at least.
In many places, it will be a choice.
Right. Let's change topic here a little bit and talk about something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is food.
Ah, okay.
So,
are you going to give me a moment? Are you a chance to plug all my?
Yes. Yeah. You're a big fan, so let's go for it. What do we have here in the Lehigh Valley as far as food is
concerned?
Well,
and again, we have to be careful, right? Because I don't want to conflate Muslim and Middle Eastern. That said, I do think this is my opportunity to give a shout out for some of my favorite Middle Eastern restaurants, many of which are not Muslim, many of which are Christian. And so one that is Muslim, Aji Halal on 2nd Street, is a Turkish restaurant, which is absolutely
in
fantastic.
Allentown, yes. And also a little shop where you can buy bread
and other goodies.
Mm-hmm,
and cherry vishne, so yeah, if I'm pronouncing that right, my husband will be laughing at me. Delicious cherry juice. Mm-hmm. Damascus is one of our favorite places to go eat. And it's
2nd Street.
2nd Street in Allentown. And it's actually a Christian Syrian restaurant. It is not Muslim. Laziz over by Josh Early Candies. Wonderful Middle Eastern food. Farmers markets, some great. I don't want to leave anybody out. I hope I'm not leaving any. We're big fans of Middle Eastern food. But again, you know, many Muslims are South Asian. As far as I know, we like ethnic foods of all sorts. But
you're saying that some of these shops are Muslim owned and some of them aren't.
Well, as I said, most of the Middle Eastern shops in Allentown are actually, there's a very large Christian Syrian community. And so most
that's interesting.
Of the, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I just moved back to the area probably a year ago, so I'm still scoping out some of these spots that I can go try out some new food, you know.
Ah.
So this is some very good tips.
Well, this isn't Middle East. Well, it is Middle East. It's not, I guess. An Ethiopian restaurant just opened.
Oh, wow.
I haven't been there yet, so I'm going to give it a shout out before I even got there.
In Allentown.
So anybody who's been waiting for Ethiopian food in Allentown, go give it a try. Hopefully it'll be good.
Cool.
I'm going to try it out next week.
So we're coming up to the closing couple minutes of the show. It was very nice to have you on tonight. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
You know, I think that if I'm going to make one final plug, it's that we really have to get to know each other and that people have to stop starting from a point of being afraid or of thinking the worst, and people have to ask questions. People have to be willing to talk to each other, because if we don't talk and ask questions and recognize the diversity, then we're never going to get to the bottom of things. We're never going to, you know, there's a lot more commonality in people generally. I think there's a lot more good and a lot more commonality than problems. So people should watch out for diversity and try to ask questions and learn.
Now, do you feel that some of your students are open-minded and do ask questions?
Most of my students are open-minded. But then I have a select group. I mean, you know, people choose to take my class.
Yes.
Right.
Well, and I can testify that Dr. Albert, the way she runs the class, it invites questions and opposing views and that kind of thing. So it's a very open
Thank you for that,
atmosphere.
John.
Yeah.
So do you find that a lot of the students that do choose to take your class, do you feel like some of them have come from some sort of knowledge of Middle Eastern culture or Islam, or some of them are just, you know, they're you know, right at the drawing board?
Well, you did it again, Ray, right? Some Middle Eastern culture. I think that very often there are students who come in because they're afraid. I think many people just don't know much at all. But I think you get people who are concerned about, you know, the current situation in the world today. And so one of the first things we start talking about is we're not going to start by talking about politics. We're not going to start by talking about the situation in the Middle East, because there are all of these other things that are so much more at the core and so much more interesting as far as I'm concerned. So,
Sharon, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you both. This has been fun.
Microphones here at WDIY. It has been fun. We wish you well and continued success with your teaching.
Thank you.
Dr. Sharon Albert from Muhlenberg College, talking to us this evening about Jews and Muslims in the United States. Ray Schwab, thank you so much for your good work this evening.
Thanks for having me back on, John.
Hey, we'll see you next month.